This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition today. I appreciate everybody joining us. My guests today have a lot of interesting things for our audience in particular because of how much surveyors get involved in FEMA-related issues, particularly with elevation certificates and letters of map amendment and those types of things. So I want to welcome today Paul Rooney and Stuart Rooney. Thank you both for being with me today.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thank you, Kurt.
Perhaps a good way to start the program would be for each of you to just give a little explanation of what your role is in the FEMA process or, and in this NFIP process.
Well, I can start. This is Paul Rooney. I work on maintaining the overall standards for the flood mapping program, and I'm also the subject matter expert for the sort of core mapping standards related to elevation and survey.
And this is Stuart Rooney, no relation to Paul Rooney. I handle the program management of letters of map change, all the LOMAs and LOMARs throughout the nation.
And as I said in the beginning, obviously the two of you are involved in activities that are very important to the surveying community in which the surveying community participates. Probably everybody at some point, whether it's, as you said, Stuart, a simple LOMA or even to the point, I guess, of just demonstrating on a survey drawing where a flood line is shown to be on the maps, that's always been sort of an interesting let me think, how shall I phrase this? Challenge, perhaps, for the surveyor who's is surveying somebody's property out in the middle of nowhere, somewhere along the way, and trying to figure out how the flood zone, as it's commonly known as the 100-year flood zone, which we know that's not really what it is, but where it actually fits from the mapping that's been available over time, and that can be challenging. And so I think with a lot of the work that you guys are doing, that process, even that simple process, as well as many others, is, I think, becoming more easy to do, or at least the information is more accessible perhaps in our computer environment.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Paul. I was just going to say, yeah, technology is you know, fiercely moving that forward. You know, you look way back when, it would be a paper application and package you'd have to mail in, but now FEMA's built some automated online tools that we could talk about later in the hour of submitting for a LOMA digitally and getting that determination right away. So, yeah, it's definitely moving more into the more digital world of things.
Right, and I think, you know, part of what you're talking about, Kurt, is our older maps, you know, were paper only, and they often didn't have any formal coordinate reference on them. And for the rural areas, they'd have very little even base map features to tie into. And in map modernization for most of the country, although not all of it, you know, we've moved over to a digital environment where the maps do show a coordinate system. And so even if you're not near a road necessarily, there is a way to at least locate that flood boundary on the new products.
Yeah, and I can certainly relate to the first part of what you just said there, because when I first got into surveying, I was working in southwestern Virginia, where a lot of areas, you know, there wasn't an actual study. The study had stopped further downstream, so to speak, but it was certainly a challenge, and there's no question that what we have today makes that better. And maybe a good place for us to start, unless you guys want to add more to that, is just to talk some about the basics of the flood insurance program.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, there's three parts conceptually. There's the insurance, which is required for certain people. There's community criteria for managing the construction that happens in the floodplain. And then there's the mapping that sort of ties those pieces together. And so FEMA, in order to make those other parts work, both identifies the area of special flood hazard, which is correlated to the 100-year flood or the 1% annual chance flood, and then also the expected elevation of that flood, and the consequence is that anyone within that special flood hazard area that has certain types of mortgages is required to buy insurance, and their insurance price is based on that flood elevation, and their construction requirements for new construction or substantial improvements is also based on that elevation. So it's always, in order to operate the NFIP, we need people who are able to make measurements relative to those flood elevations and relative to the position of the special flood hazard area.
And I guess the one of the things that always comes up in conversation is the whole idea of the insurance itself, and at what points is it absolutely required. And as a matter of fact, we were having NSPS has an insurance program for our members, and I have routinely the lady who manages the program for us is on the show, and we were talking the other day about the whole insurance thing, and that how your normal homeowner's insurance doesn't cover a flood in most cases, or maybe in all cases, and so people can end up having their house flooded because of a storm event, but it wasn't within a designated flood area, so to speak. And so I think a lot of us never even think about that if we live, like, for example, I live at the highest point in my development, so I don't think so much about flood, but my house could get flooded if I had backup in my drains or something. So just making that distinction that the flood insurance you guys are talking about is either mandated or optional, I guess, for people, but it doesn't cover, or our normal insurance doesn't cover what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think typically most private insurers started to exclude flood or would exclude flood from their policies because of certain people are at much higher risk than others, given the lay of the land and where their houses are located. And so historically, there'd be large flood events and very little insurance coverage, and that was the origins of the National Flood Insurance Program, is that Congress saw that as a problem. People there'd be these massive bailouts after a large flood, and they hoped that by setting up the National Flood Insurance Program, it would provide more of a mechanism for people who are at most at risk to pool their risk and obtain insurance that would help them in the event of a big flood. So it's true that most private homeowners doesn't cover, although there's some limited coverage, I think, in certain policies. But by and large, if you don't have a National Flood Insurance Program, flood insurance policy, you probably don't have any coverage for flood.
Very true. And I guess one of the things that always comes up in the surveying committee, and we can grasp this later or talk about it later if you like, but one of the things that always comes up in discussion is, what are the numbers in terms of requests for amendments and that type of thing? Is that, from the surveyor's perspective, it seems to be high, but I don't know if that's really true.
Yeah, there's several reasons why you can come in for a letter of map amendment. A lot of it has to do, maybe, is a lot of development going on, and it's not a reflection to what the maps are portraying. It's just changes in areas will generate the letters of map change. So there's that correlation, and there's also the socioeconomic of the factors that go into account for increased LOMAs or decreased LOMAs. I know when the recession, the economy went down, letter of map changes kind of slowed down a bit, and now with the mortgage rates kind of being low, now they're picking up again. So there's all these different factors that kind of move into that realm of letter of map change and supply and demand.
And talking about that base flood elevation that we were chatting about a minute ago, maybe it would be instructional to talk a little bit about the basis of what it's referenced to, the vertical datum, because as we know, we have a mixture today of old maps and new maps, and so maybe you could talk about that a little bit in terms of where we are and where we're headed in terms of how that will be utilized.
Sure, that's the premise of the program is that we publish the base flood elevations referenced to a standardized datum, so that it can be reproduced by a professional surveyor, you know, from their own measurements. And the current policy is that all the new mapping has to be referenced to NAVD 88. But like you said, we have a pretty substantial legacy issue with maps that were, you know, primarily produced on NGVD 29 over the first 30 plus years of the program, and even some that are referenced to local datums or just reference mean sea level. And of course, outside the continental U.S., we have issues with, you know, what datums are available for folks. So, you know, the future going forward is we want to be on NAVD 88 and even working with Geodetic Survey on their planning for the next, you know, update to their vertical datum, so that it's, you know, we can be as compatible as we can with modern survey techniques. But with those legacy maps, we still need to be able to make measurements and reference them to NGV 29 because those are the, you know, governing documents for the communities that still have those maps.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing to talk about, and I don't know if you want to expound on that or not, but I think in our previous conversations you guys were talking about when information is provided, it needs to be referenced to whatever the map was referenced to rather than reference to a new system. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's right. Our standard mechanism for documenting elevations to the program is the FEMA Elevation Certificate. And the way the information is structured on that is we ask for all the elevations provided to always be referenced to the same datum that's on the map. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to perform your survey entirely in 29. Recognize that really the best approach is typically to work off the most current coordinates for the control that you're using, but we do need it to be then adjusted over to match the datum from the map. And there's even some specific instructions on the elevation certificate about places where there's, you know, motion in the benchmarks, so subsidence or what have you, that we want it to be referenced to the most recent realization on that benchmark so that the, you know, the base flood elevation isn't going down with the benchmark, that it we try to maintain it at the height as it was originally defined at, even though the benchmarks may be moving with relative to it.
Right. And when we come back from our break, it's coming up in 30 seconds or so, we'll want to talk about elevation certificates. But I did want to talk about that because sometimes the tendency is to attach ourselves to the whatever the latest iteration of datum is, and that's going to be continually changing as technology changes. So I wanted to make sure that we got that point across and everybody understood that, because it does make perfect sense that you need to reference back to whatever the map was created in order for you to provide what you need. So let's go to that first break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com, and thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Quick steaks are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden steaks, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Steaks, go to www.quicksteak.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back with Paul Rooney and Stuart Rooney today with FEMA, talking about a variety of things, the National Flood Insurance Program, as we talked about in the first segment. And our conversation led us up to the concept of elevation certificates. So although I suspect our audience is somewhat familiar with it, perhaps just defining what elevation certificates are would be a good place to start.
Sure. You know, there's two primary situations where a homeowner or property owner wants to demonstrate to FEMA the elevation for their home. One is just rating their insurance. It's the primary criteria, in addition to building type, that determines what the flood insurance rate is going to be. And so for most buildings, more modern buildings, in order to get an insurance policy, you need to get a determination of what the first floor elevation is. And so the elevation certificate is the form that you submit that on. The other application is the area Stuart's responsible for is if you believe that we've inadvertently included your property in the floodplain because you think that the elevation of your house is actually above the flood elevation that we've published, you can have a survey done to demonstrate that as well. And so you submit the elevation certificate to document that the house is higher than the estimated flood elevation, and so as a result, you're not actually in the floodplain. So it's the FEMA official form for putting that information in. It has information, you know, about the community that you're in and the property, the base flood elevation shown on the map, and then the elevations for the structure that the surveyor measures.
Well, Stuart, since that is your area, maybe you can give us some details about the goals and what elevation certificates are accomplish.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. So, in the world of letter or map amendments, what FEMA wants to see for a successful removal from the special flood hazard year area or 100-year flood is that elevation certificates submitted to us, sealed, stamped, certified. And what we're looking for a letter of map amendment, and that would be a house on natural ground, no fill brought in. We're looking for the lowest adjacent grade, the lowest corner of that house, to be at that flood elevation as shown on our flood maps or FIS report, that lowest adjacent grade at the flood elevation or higher. We would use the elevation certificate to make that decision. And there's also FEMA uses an elevation form, which is less information needed, just what they're requesting, requiring the lowest adjacent grade.
So when the surveyor is going to be asked to provide the information for the certificate, I think it can be confusing in a lot of cases because certainly in some cases, the surveyor just isn't accustomed to doing the work. I mean, there are some places in the country, I suppose, where you're located, where floodplains issues are prominent. But in many cases, surveyors just don't understand or don't grasp exactly what it is they're supposed to do. So they're always looking for, well, how am I supposed to go about doing this? And you guys don't really give specific direction, I mean, on how to do that, I don't think.
Yeah, we rely on the surveyor, certified professional, to understand what's required. But it's interesting you should say that because I do see that a lot in, for property owners. You know, I can't afford a big survey or cross-sections on my house. And I think that's where there's some miscommunication. For a LOMA, we don't need an extensive kind of engineering study. All we want is the lowest adjacent grade of that house, shoot that elevation, and then submit it with the application. So there is a kind of difference in the scope of work there. I have heard that complaint a lot, and we're really just looking for that lowest adjacent grade for a letter of map amendment.
So you're not really looking for the surveyor to, or whoever's going to provide the information, to determine the flood line or the flood elevation. You're looking for them to give you the information that you can then go make that comparison, if I'm understanding correctly.
Yeah, so there's two different kind of special flood hazard zones. One we call a detailed one, where FEMA actually has come in and run some H&H modeling and use updated topo to develop a flood elevation for that flood zone. There's another flood zone where we use more calculated approximate methods, and that's a zone A with no number. That is the one where usually it could be costly to develop a BFE. Usually the application gets submitted, and we'll most likely send another letter out asking to see if a zone, if a BFE has been established in the area. And we usually refer folks to the Army Corps, sometimes comes in due to transportation projects, DOT, community, developer sometimes has a BFE on hand. So we usually look to see if a BFE has been established. And if not, then sometimes FEMA will go ahead and calculate a BFE on behalf of the property owner if it meets certain criteria.
I know we're going to talk about the mapping process a little more later on in the show, but I guess one of the questions I have is, with new mapping and enhanced methodology for mapping over what we've done in the past, and as you pointed out, in the old days, if we want to call them that, the surveys certainly weren't done with the technology that we have today. So I guess the question is there an anticipation with the types of collection methods we have now and the processes for gathering the data? Is there an anticipation that there will be more area covered by established BFE? Is that a goal, or is it still going to be just in certain selected areas?
Yeah, it is. It's a specific goal of the risk map program, which is what we're calling the flood insurance mapping program. That all the new work that we do now in terms of mapping, we have a standard that says we're always going to use a model for it, and we're always going to compute several different flood elevations, including the 1% annual chance elevation. It doesn't necessarily say that we'll always publish it. There might be situations where a community doesn't feel like we need to publish the base flood elevations because the way their zoning is set up, it's less important. For example, some communities allow no development in the special flood hazard area. So for their purposes, having a base flood elevation isn't really necessary for their local permitting process. And there might be some other variations where, from a local perspective, they don't need the base flood elevations, they don't want them. But by and large, our current approach is that we're going to be doing flood elevations for almost all the new work that we're doing. So it should be increasing over time, the amount of coverage that has the flood elevations published.
One of the things I'm curious about, too, is, and this is just based on history of my own interaction on this, but I know there's data that localities provide sometimes, and I'm not sure if that's going to continue to be the case as the overall mapping becomes more prominent, but I just always thought that must be a daunting task to have the information that you've collected, and then a community does a new study, and you have to interject that in and make it work with the mapping that you have. Is that as difficult as it sounds to me, or is it pretty simple to do?
No, I think it's always a problem. Not a problem, but it's always a challenge. On our current process, we've put more focus on the upfront parts of the study to really get together with the communities and understand what their needs are in terms of managing their floodplains and managing their risks, and to understand what's ongoing in terms of their data. Are they doing new mapping of the community or new analysis of their floodplains or whatnot? But it is a challenge to keep those things in sync, particularly with, some areas are very active in terms of their own flood studies. Denver Urban Drainage and Flood Control is a large water management district in the Denver metropolitan area, and they're constantly doing new studies. Maricopa County around Phoenix, Arizona, is constantly doing new analysis, and the regional offices develop really close working relationships with them in order to try to sync things up as best as possible. But I think the other mechanism for smaller types of changes that come in is the letter map revision process. And I don't know, Stuart, if you want to explain a little bit how that would work.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So, yeah, on the other side of the LOMA spectrum, you have a letter of map revision, and what happens is developers come in, we'll do an example, developer comes in, starts building, kind of changes the characteristics of the area, the flooding source, things like that. And if you're a participating community in NFIP, it's your job to inform FEMA, things have changed here, the party has changed, we put some to subdivision, and we need to reflect that on the maps. So a letter of map revision is it is a physical change to our flood insurance rate map panel. It would come in and show the area of revision of what's changed. FEMA would take a look at the H&H modeling. They'd make sure the community's on board, getting community concurrence. And then we would go ahead and actually change the map and issue that letter, a map revision letter, showing that panel how it's changed with the new H&H modeling and so forth. And, you know, that goes to a monthly compendium where people subscribe, insurance agents, banks, so they become aware that this map area has changed and this is the new revision, more updated special flood hazard area depiction, so to speak.
Yeah, I would think that probably becomes more challenging in rapidly developing areas where those types of changes are going to occur because of new construction and new roads and all those kind of things.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that goes back to what I was saying earlier with the socioeconomic. Once the economy picks up, you see letter of map revision start picking up quite a bit, you know, in the same correlation and speed. So the developers are out there. There's a lot of land on what that small creek could be at 100 year. It could be a very big flooding source. So you got to take in all those characteristics, and you got to come forward and say, well, we've done our H&H modeling. This stream special flood hazard, it could shrink, it could expand. It's not depicted correctly on our maps. We see that on old maps, and here's a new revision to it. So,
yeah, I guess that's an interesting thought. When those types of things happen, is there a, and I know we have about 45 seconds before the break, maybe we'll have to pick this up later, but is there a schedule on which when major changes like that occur, the locality has to submit that information, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a good question. So if you're a member of the NFIP, you have 6 months from the date of that project to submit the FEMA to show the changes. So it's on a six-month time span.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. And that brings us up to within a few seconds of our second break. So we'll come back and follow up on that and then talk some about the mapping process when we get back after the break.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details. Or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's schonstedt.com.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings for Medicine on Call and participate in a lively conversation. Learn what's happening behind the headlines in medicine. Understand Obamacare. And learn how to protect yourself and navigate the system.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to schonstedt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back with Paul and Stuart the Roonies, although not related Roonies, talking about FEMA issues, and David was just telling me at the break that FedEx is down. I guess that's a big deal for a lot of people. But during this segment, at the beginning of the third segment, it's when we always have our Parker Davis Quick Stakes contest for the week. The person to repeat the answer that's provided to the question needs to respond to Quick Stakes Contest at AmericasWebRadio.com. So the question for today, as we were departing from our second segment, we were talking about letters of map revision and the timing with which changes need to be reported, I guess, after the completion of the work. So what was that time frame again?
That's 6 months.
6 months. So that's the answer we're looking for today, folks, for the Quick Stakes Contest question is 6 months. Thank you for participating in that with us. We appreciate it very much. So I know we want to talk about the mapping process. I don't know if we need to cover more on the letter of map revision. I think having talked about that may perhaps clear that up a little bit for some in our audience, because letter of map amendment, letter of map revision obviously are two somewhat different things, and so it was important, I think, for our audience to understand what those actually mean and who's responsible for filing them. And we did talk a little bit about the LOMA and what the landowner encounters, and I don't know if there's other things you want to share about that with the audience. As I said before, I think we talked about this in our preparation leading up to this, is sometimes our surveyor population is somewhat reluctant to actually file the LOMA itself, always provide the elevation certificate, but it's not absolutely required that the LOMA is submitted by the surveyor. But is it helpful if that's the case, or does it make a difference?
It doesn't make a difference. You know, you could have the surveyor gather all the data, and a part of their business philosophy and part of their services, hey, I will not only do the Lewis adjacent grade and elevation certificate, I'll collect all the other necessary data, such as maybe a plat map, the recorded deed of the house, package that all up and send it into FEMA. Or the surveyor could just simply fill out the elevation certificate, you know, state what else is needed, and let the property owner go and get that data and send it in. It makes no difference to FEMA as long as, you know, the package is complete and we can process it. So it's really a decision that could be done by on the surveyor side on how he or she would like to submit.
Right. And I've heard some folks say they prefer to do it because they fear there may be some misinterpretation of the data the professional surveyor has provided when the forms go in. I don't know if that ever occurs or not, but people do have the fear of that, I think. So I think it's good to point out that this is really a business model choice for the surveyor on whether or not how broadly they want that piece of their service to go.
Yeah, and again, how many cases are you submitting on behalf of your client? Things like that could be big factors in deciding, you know, do you want to expand and you know, soup the nuts, I'll take it right from the beginning to the end and get that LOMA determination, or, you know, I'll just complete the elevation certificate. Here you go. Here's the next steps you need to do, and then get on to the next client. So, yeah, it is more or less what's your business model? How do you want to handle that?
And the other thing we were talking about with the letters of map revision, it's easy to see how important those are, because one of the things I was going to ask was, is there a predetermined mapping schedule that you guys follow in terms of getting new data, or is it come about sometimes as a local community wants to get involved? Or I guess I'm just not sure about what that process is for who decides when new mapping occurs, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's pretty complicated in terms of prioritizing. You know, we have some high-level objectives, you know, in order to target the places where there's the most flood risk and where the current flood maps are not up to date. You know, so that's strategically our objective. We also factor in where communities are interested in partnering with us, particularly if they're bringing cost share in the form of, you know, either work or data or money. But then, you know, within that high-level objectives, each regional office does a lot of work with their state offices and with the local communities to really figure out what the best schedule is to put in place. So, you know, communities can always contact the regional office if they feel like they have a need for a new flood map, new flood study, or if they have new data that they think would you know, help improve their existing flood map, and sort of work into the process that way, or coordinate up through their state NFIP coordinating office as well. But there's no completely systematic way. There's some strategic objectives that we apply on a case-by-case basis to try to come up with the best priority for what area we should work in next.
Yeah, right. I can see where a community that doesn't change much over time perhaps doesn't need new mapping nearly as much as I've been in Northern Virginia now for about 27 years, and it looks totally different than when I got here, and it's been changing every day. So I can see where a lot of development occurs. There might be more of a need, and where local government would want to be involved more directly in making sure that happens than in other areas. And then I guess sometimes catastrophic events. I know back after Floyd, when North Carolina started a really aggressive mapping program, partially because of the flood. So I guess those events also have some impact, don't they?
They do. I think, you know, oftentimes there'll be a big event, and it will raise awareness of the how old the current maps are, or what the hazard is they depict relative to the new hazard. Or in many cases, you know, the events will happen while we're in the middle of a project. You know, it often takes 3 to 5 years from beginning to end on a flood study, and so it's not unusual to have those events happen in midstream, and then the event can often influence the final product with additional data on those storms and other information that comes up through that process. But I think, you know, these different processes kind of work together to provide a lot of different options for getting the maps updated, and you know, So the FEMA-initiated formal map update process is a pretty slow process, right? We might only visit even an active community once every 10 years with a major update, and for less active communities on a longer time frame than that. But the letter of map revision process always provides that opportunity for a locally originated change to come in and say, hey, you know, you haven't been here recently to update our maps, but we know this change took place, and we're documenting and submitting it to you to process.
Yeah, I know in recent months we've been involved in promoting the whole idea of the Digital Coast Act and what it's going to do, and I guess that has some implications for you guys as well with the mapping that it will entail.
I have to confess, Kurt, I'm not really familiar with the specific requirements of the Digital Coast Map.
It's pretty new legislation, or actually not legislation exactly yet, but it's being promoted. And the idea is to, obviously on the coastlines, but not only on the coastlines, in other areas, get a better process for keeping up with things. So that leading forward will hopefully be something that helps out.
We do a lot of work with NOAA, and there's a working group called the Interagency Working Group on Ocean and Coastal Mapping that came out of some earlier legislation related to integrated coastal mapping framework for federal agencies.
And I think this act may have come up as a result of what you're talking about,
possibly.
At least that was maybe the impetus for it originally. I'm not certain about that. But
Coastal Zone over the last 5 years initiated updates for most of the populated coastline at this point. We started in about 2009, and most of that work's underway, although not a lot of it's complete yet. As I mentioned, many of these take quite a long time to get them completed.
As I was looking through the information you guys sent on the mapping process, where you were talking about having accuracy standards and using LIDAR data, and then one of the things you wrote was structures and cross-section surveys are sometimes required, it threw me back to 40 years ago, I guess, stretching cables across rivers with weights on them to do depth of water soundings for these types of studies and then carrying them out over the flatlands out from the rivers. And I guess maybe some of that still occurs, maybe in a different way, but I just recall that that was a pretty big job back in the day.
Yeah, and I think, you know, LIDAR technology has, and even photogrammetric technology, 25, 30 years back, to some degree, you know, have been changing that paradigm. But you're right, the old method in the 70s was we would make individual measurements perpendicular to the stream as a cross-section, generate an elevation profile for that cross-section, and those were the inputs to the models. And nowadays, it's much more likely that we'll have a LIDAR terrain surface, and that most of those elevations will come out of that LIDAR data product. And the gaps are the submerged portion of the river where the LIDAR isn't making measurements, and then all the structures that cross the river where you can't measure the dimensions underneath a bridge from an airplane that flies overhead. You know, and so that's where the survey mainly factors in these days is where there's a large capacity of the channel that's underwater, making measurements through there, and also measuring, you know, the culverts and bridges and dams and other structures that that impede the flow at the high water levels.
Yeah, my most vivid recollections, I think, are trying to hold the boat steady and upright in rapid streams when you're holding on to the cable. Those were some exciting times, and it's good to know maybe some people still get to do that. So,
yep, and it's always interesting to me that we, you know, precise elevations are often a source of friction in the flood insurance program. Right, people want to demonstrate their house isn't in the floodplain because they believe it's, you know, safer than our maps are showing, and then you trace back to how some of these things work, and you know, some depths are defined by, you know, how far your disc sinks into the muck before it stops. And
Right, that's very true. So it's all relative to some degree, I suppose.
Right.
We're getting near our last break, and so when we come back, one of the things that the surveying population is interested in, we talked about this a little bit before we put the show, or as we were putting the show together, and that was the LOMA process, the expansion of the eLOMA process, what that's going to mean, and what the involvement in that is through the surveying community and those types of things. So when we come back, maybe we can finish up by talking about that and then perhaps have you guys crystal ball the future a little bit, if there's any way to do that on where we're headed in terms of looking at this in the future. So let's go to break.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our last segment with Paul Rooney and Stuart Rooney. One of you guys was asking before we came back from break, was there something we needed to chat about that we want to bring up here? Because we can talk about that now. We don't have to be offline to talk about it if you had something else you wanted to throw out.
No.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about the LOMA process, because as you have both pointed out, that's maybe the part of this that's most involved for the surveying community. And may talk about the LOMA and the eLOMA and looking ahead and where all that seems to be going.
Yeah, so, FEMA developed, we saw the increase after increase of LOMAs each year. I think, Kurt, you were asking earlier, we get about 38,000 LOMAs a year. 6,000 of those are digital and mostly coming from what we call our eLOMA. And it's a web-based application where if you sign up to be a licensed professional, you can gain access to this eLOMA system and enter information to process a LOMA digitally and get a determination within minutes. You have to do the data entry up front. It's submitted by the licensed professionals, we'd like to say, but it gets you a quick LOMA determination, because one of the things I forgot to mention is a lot of times flood insurance gets generated at refinancing or closing and things like that. A lot of property owners, they're told they need flood insurance at a closing and things like that. They don't have a lot of time, and we kind of recognize that I don't believe I'm in the flood zone by way of elevation, but gathering that paperwork and sending it in via mail can take time. So we have this eLOMA. You can do it digitally and hopefully get a faster response determination from FEMA. So it's essentially just data entry up front by the user, putting in all the key information, like the legal property description, the requester information, which could be the surveyor, could be the property owner, surveyor submitting on behalf of the property owner, and the map panel information, the lat long things where we can hone in. And the key thing, of course, is that lowest adjacent grade where that inputted online. It's submitted online, and then we quickly generate it and compare it to our flood maps, see what the base flood elevation, and we quickly can make a determination, if that lag is at or above the BFE, we can say this structure is removed from the flood zone. There are limitations to the eLOMA. Right now, it's only taking very straightforward LOMAs, meaning a single lot residential structure in a detailed flood zone area where a flood elevation has been established. So there are those limitations, but we're in the process of trying to expand that to all LOMAs, meaning all different flood zones. We're trying to build in a more tracking database for the licensed professionals where they'd log in and they'd somewhat have a workbench there showing all their submitted cases they've done, the submitted cases that are still in progress that have a status to it. So a little more user-friendly other than just submitting it into a system and, where is it now kind of thing. So we found it's growing. It's growing about 10-15% a year. A lot of good things are coming out of it. We're getting those determinations out quicker. The general correspondence is via email. It's quick. You can get the approved email within minutes. The beginning, when you log in and you sign up as a licensed professional, the case does get audited to make sure everything lines up appropriately and everything like that, and then you get audited. And if it comes back okay, then you can submit a few more, then we'll pull another random audit. So it's a good program. It's on hazards.fema.gov. We like it. It gets you a quick determination. It's growing. We hope to expand it. We are in the process. I'm hoping by February to get that new kind of reporting system built into eLOMA, open it up to more LOMAs, not just detailed flood zones, but maybe multiple structure LOMAs where you have maybe two buildings side by side that you could submit for LOMA. So we're trying to build on it. We're definitely seeing the uptick, as I said, and use. And so we've been liking it.
Well, I can see where it would be something the surveyors and I guess other professionals, because I think aren't professional engineers allowed to submit through eLOMA as well?
Yes.
Or is it only surveyors?
No, professional engineers can submit too.
I was thinking that was true. Yeah, so I can see where people would like that process. I think we talked about when we were doing our initial interview the Certified Floodplain Surveyor program that we worked with the folks in North Carolina to set up after Floyd, and that was really a popular idea around the country. And so I think with the, and of course that was related to LOMA applications, not to ELOMA applications, but it seems as though what you've created here even expedites things even more. So, and that expansion that you're talking about, I believe, will be very welcome among our professional community to go beyond the single lot and the detailed study area. If that becomes possible, that'll make it an even better tool. I was a little surprised, actually, when you said out of 38,000 applications, only six were ELOMA currently. That I would have thought it would be a higher number than that.
Yeah, it's growing. It fluctuates. But then, like 2013, it was 6,000. Before that, it was 4,500. So it is growing. But I think with these enhancements and getting the word out, it'll start to take off. And you know, people like to know when they submit, you know, the status and things like that. And rather than packaging up, put in the mail and sending it to the government and wondering where things are. So I remember we did a survey, you know, what are the things that, you know, people like and don't like, and doing the LOMA application and everything, and people didn't, you know, it goes out in the abyss, it gets sent, and no one knows what's going on with the case. But now with these, hopefully, these enhancements we're trying to roll out, you know, you'd have a workbench there, you could see the status, you wouldn't have to call in, give your case number, and see where we are with the process and things like that. So it's a little more on this enhancement, a little bit more user-friendly, those enhancements.
Well, I can certainly see where it would be something that the folks in the loan closing business, as you mentioned earlier, would be happy about as well, because anything that slows down what they're doing is not a good thing from their perspective. So I can be pleased about that.
Yeah, you're sitting in there getting closing on a house, and you're told you need flood insurance out of nowhere, and it's a big hefty bill, and you seem to think by way of elevation, I'm just not in the flood zone, but we're going to force places flood insurance. Well, you know, being a registered user at ULOMI could help you get that determination a lot quicker and bring it to the bank, so to speak.
Seems like it might connect back to what, you know, the question you were asking earlier, Kurt, about whether the surveyors submit the LOMAs on behalf of their clients or not. In order to submit, you have to be, you know, a registered professional. So if they're not submitting on behalf of their customers, it's going to come in through the paper.
Right.
Mechanism. Right.
Yeah, and that certainly would be instrumental in that business model that Stuart was talking about as well, because if it has to be submitted by a professional, then if you're going to provide the service, so to speak, to your client rather than just give them information and hand it off, then that the value of that service would certainly go down, I would think.
Yeah.
So that makes perfect sense. Well, that's good to know that I know there's been discussion about this for quite some time now in terms of how far the electronic process is going to be able to go in terms of the different types of applications or situations. So I'm sure as that gets expanded that it will certainly be a positive for those in the community of our membership for sure. So once again, you said that information can be found at hazards.fema.gov. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So a surveyor could go there or other allowed professional could go there and get information about how the system works.
That's correct. There's some fact sheets set up there. It's also MIPHelp is what we call it. They're the ones that can set you up, and a new user can set you up an account for ELOMA and begin submitting via the ELOMA website tool.
Yeah, actually, that's something that would, I think, be a good idea for me to share in our weekly newsletter with people, to provide that website for them to go to and check this out. And I don't know if I need to tell them more, but if they can find what they need by going there and just get some facts, I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah.
So we got a couple, three minutes left here. What do you guys see for the future? Is everything going online, and are we going to be defining authoritative flood positions off of the maps in the future? How's that going to go, or do you know yet?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been our objective on the mapping program really for going on probably 10 years to move things to the web, you know, and I think, you know, eLoma is a great example of that, right? And, you know, we've been providing our maps online for a number of years, and we just overhauled the map distribution website to really make it easier and simpler to use. And, you know, we have some new views online that show you not just the old sort of replica of a paper map online, but show you digital, you know, geospatial maps online. And in, I think it was 2004, maybe 2006, there was a reform bill for the NFIP, the, I can't even get the names right, three congressmen, Benning, B. Ryder, and a third one. And it had a provision in it that we actually had to allow the digital map data to be used along with the paper maps and have them both be, you know, legal under the NFIP. And so we did that by putting out a policy that said we were defining the position of the flood zone relative to the coordinate system shown on the map and the coordinate system shown in the digital data. It kind of links all the way back to your one of your very first questions, Kurt, about, you know, the old maps were kind of floating in space, and if there weren't very many roads on that map, it was almost impossible to say with certainty where that floodplain boundary was. And in this digital world, we knew we had to be more specific about that, so we tried to define it in a structured way that was clear and unambiguous. So even if you might have four or five different base maps that you might put next to the flood data, each which might be in a slightly different position, there was some way to figure out what the authoritative answer was. And I think that's where we'll be heading with more GPS locations for structures relative to the floodplain and more real-time information available to people as they navigate through the NFIP processes.
Yeah, that's, and we're about the end of the time here, and I agree with you. I think that's going to be a help to everybody. And so before I run out of time and don't do it, I really appreciate you both being with me today. It's been great information, and I know that our audience is going to enjoy it, whether they're listening now or whether they listen to the podcast later on. And I will, in fact, show this website as we talked about before, and perhaps we can have another conversation about this going down the road. But it's been great to have you both on the show today.
Well, thank you,
Kurt.
Appreciate
the time. Thank you.
And thank you. So you guys take care, and hopefully we'll be talking sometime soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.